Welcome to the Destination Next podcast. This is a podcast hosted by me, Chris Hall, in collaboration with Sterker. With this podcast, we're going to be celebrating everything endurance, supporting the everyday athlete who are maybe not necessarily in the limelight. People are now going further, faster, and better on the products they're training with and with the equipment they've got. Sterker offer a range of nutritional, carbohydrate-based products that are vegan and super friendly on your stomach. And you can use discount code NEXT10 at www.sterker.com to get 10% off your next order.
Just doing that before I forget.
Yeah.
So I've got Matt Ryan here for this episode of Destination Next podcast. And Matt, do you know what? Your little description of who you are on the PCR website is great. Who wrote that?
I wrote it. A long time ago. I wrote it back in 2018, I think it was.
It's quite funny. I read it and I was like, yeah, I quite like that. I like the idea of the fact that you enjoy sleeping in bushes and in football stadiums, all that kind of stuff. I thought it was quite funny. And
yeah, I mean, that's the reality of doing long rides, isn't it? If you're going to do a really long ride, you're not going to be getting home in time for to sleep. So you end up sleeping out on the road.
It's just a case of finding the right spot. And I'm sure you've definitely done what I've done and you've like set up somewhere and then within 20 minutes or half an hour or so, you're like, shit, this is a really, really not a good place to be. The one that always stands in my mind was when I set up everything in Badlands and realized I was on an ant's nest.
No.
Yeah, it's not fun. You're just like, let's get rid of that one. Let's get rid of that one. Get rid of that one. Okay, there's now 100 of them on me. Something's not right here. Lift up the bivy bag and you're like, that explains that one. That's exactly what I did.
I had the same issue when I was crossing from Serbia into, I can't remember where it is now. Is it Serbia into Greece, maybe?
Yeah.
What's the place called between Greece and Serbia?
Find that map quickly.
Well, anyway, that's crossing the border and it's like really difficult to get across this border. And I made multiple attempts and at one point I almost, these kids offered to smuggle me across the border because the border guards weren't letting us through. There was a motorway and we weren't allowed to use the motorway. So I was just trying to find a way around, couldn't. And I bought a can of Coke and I opened it and it exploded all over me and the drone kit anyway. But it's like, I was sticky with Coca-Cola. It's all over my handlebars. Managed to get through this border eventually about three in the morning. Just went a little bit further along, pulled up to one side and just slept. And when I woke up in the morning, I could feel all these little tingles all over my chest, over my hands. And I woke up and looked up and there was just ants everywhere. And they were just all feeding off this dried syrup. So I got up, brushed them all off and I was naked.
Brilliant.
And shook my clothes, got back on the bike. Started riding, but then for the whole morning and afternoon, ants just kept popping out of different parts of my handlebars. You know, they'd been like nibbling Coca-Cola and then just come out. So it's like riding along, come flicking them off and just not nice.
Is that there's, I think there's something with like any kind of ultra races or even like, you know, just Audaxing and bike packing, I love all the kind of stories that come out of it, but the little things that are the weird things that you remember, and ants is definitely one. I think a lot of people have probably had issues with at various points. They seem, as you say, they just seem to get everywhere. One of my mates who rode, it's a story that I was told while I was riding to Switzerland, another mate who rode across America always had biscuits on him for some reason. Well, obviously to eat, always have biscuits. But with those biscuits, there was always a trail of crumbs. And with that trail of crumbs, there was always ants. So he always had ants like in pockets and bags and stuff like that. And whatever happened, you'd always find these ants with him. And it's just like, they're the little guys that just get everywhere and really muck stuff up.
Yeah, they are. They're a pain in the arse. But
was that a TCR number 5?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, what an amazing experience to have done that as well. Like, I can't even think what edition they're on now. 7, maybe?
7 or 8. Still going well. Still going strong. That was the last one. That was the last route that I think Mike had directly planned himself.
Yeah.
The accident earlier in the year. We rode it that year. It was good. It was a really good addition. The finish was amazing. Had my family come out to meet me at the end and just hung out with some cool people.
Yeah.
Nice times.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's really, I think, is really rewarding on them is that, that I know, like Badlands especially, it's probably very similar. Everyone kind of hangs around at the end, has a few beers, has some food. Christian from Sturka and myself, we kept like crossing paths quite a lot in Badlands. And I took a wrong turn with like 50k to go and didn't realize, and I ended up descending this mountain and had to climb back up this mountain and then jump back on the route. It was a 60 kilometer detour, so kind of annoying, but it is what it is. These things happen. And got to the end. We all like had dinner at this just like little tiny little Spanish restaurant and had a few, you know, a few drinks. And then Christian decided to go and buy some rugs. And I was like, so he's saved in my phone as Christian Rugman, because he bought these rugs and he asked me, because he was going to go and cycle back to Granada where the start was. And I would have loved to, but I did that race injured and I definitely finished it very injured. So he was like, oh, any chance you could like take the rugs back to Granada with me and I'll pick them up from you. And they were like, you know, meter long, rolled up and probably like 3 meters like in total length. And I was like, yeah, no problem. So he like met me in the morning with this like roll of rugs. I took it back to Granada and then he met me in the hotel lobby where I was staying and was like, cheers for that. And that was basically how our friendship kind of really started, because I've just always gotten saved as the rug man in my phone. But it's like there's something lovely about how those stories, and I think with PCR, there's been that feeling with the race that you know yourself and, you know, Toby, and I believe your wife as well have been
involved. She's like the anchor stone, you know, in the middle of us all. She's very important.
Yeah, and there's a real, what I've always thought of what you guys have done as well, is it feels like there's a real community aspect of it. And whether that's with doing the race, the organized like rides you do around the race and the meetups, and then now with the gravel rally as well, it feels like it's really growing and evolving as an event and the series of events. And I think the important bit to also remember is that all of you don't do it full time. You all have other jobs.
Yeah. So my wife, she works for Siemens. She has quite an important job working in there. To be honest with you, I don't even quite understand what it is. Plans, lots of stuff. So she's planning and organising, but she's like a key decision maker there as well. Toby got a new job this year, which he's really enjoying, which is going out to sort of almost like emergency situations that involve electrical equipment and fields, what have you. And I work in the fire service, so all of the planning for the race has to fit in amongst our full-time jobs, but then it also has to squeeze in amongst our personal lives, and then it has to squeeze in between our own riding, and then it has to squeeze in between having relationships with our children and stuff like this. So it does feel like it's just constant. It's you know, we have two jobs. I probably spend more time thinking about this job than I do anything, about this event, about the Pan Celtic, than I do anything else. It's a full-time preoccupation for me mentally.
Yeah, of course.
It's just, especially at this point in the sort of the last week and a half before it happens, just tons to do, tons. But it's great. It's all good. And it keeps us excited.
Yeah, of course. And I think what you've done this year with providing, you've done a longer route and a shorter route, haven't you? So yeah. I think that's a great way to sort of start to introduce for people who are maybe new into the whole kind of bikepacking and ultra stuff, but are really excited to get involved in it. It really allows them to, I guess, test it out and see if it works for them by doing the short route. And like, I mean, the short route is like just over 1,000 miles.
We call it the shorter route because we don't want people thinking that by riding the the shorter route, it's any less challenging than riding the longer route. You know, it still has, you're still riding along, I don't know, 80% of the same road, the same route as the other riders.
Yeah.
And it is geared towards people that are, like you say, wanting to dip their toe into the scene and have a go at riding those distances. It's a perfect distance for that.
Yeah, definitely.
About 5-6 days, going at a nice, easy pace, and you can really immerse yourself in it. But it's also, it's a great option for people that don't have the time to do a full route. So we have somebody this year, one of our riders that comes back every time, James Houston, Mr. Brompton.
Yeah.
He was down for the long route this year, managed to secure himself a place on another event, which he'd been waiting to do for a long time, and decided, rather than miss the Pan Celtic, he swapped down to the shorter route because he'll have enough time to do the shorter route and then still go and do the other event. So that works. And it's like that for a lot of people, you know, professionals that only have limited amount of days off in a year that they can spare to do an event like this. In the short route, you can do it in a week. You
know, great. It's really good to offer that sort of I think it's great to be able to offer that different options for people out there. And I think a lot of people maybe don't understand that people that often do these kind of races have got full-time jobs and, like you said yourself, family, kids, job, social life.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to juggle at once as a race organizer or as someone entering these kind of races. And I think that's one of the things that's always appealed to me personally, is the fact that you get very few people. You do obviously get people that do train and do it as their job. Like we've seen that at Badlands and, you know, at various other ultra races where like Lachlan Morton's turned up or Alistair Brownlee's turned up. But for me, the bit that's always exciting and fascinating is the stories of the people who have come at it from a very normal life to try something very completely different to what they would normally do. And it's great. And that's what's so appealing. I think that ultra cycling can really kind of appeal to any person. If someone wants to do it, there's no real limitation.
Yeah, I like the fact as well that ultra cycling has sort of grown up from the grassroots, and it's not something that has sort of been led by professional riders. You know, it's something that normal people have gone out and have achieved great things on their bikes. And for me, that's so much more appealing to see and to hear about than to have some professional rider come along and set the fastest known time. Because yeah, that's great. But, you know, that's their full time profession, and they're at the pinnacle of the human food chain, if you like. So you know, yeah, great. You should be able to go out and do it, and you should be able to smash it really easy. But what I'm interested in is the dentist or the farmer or the bricklayer or whoever. Who's got their bike, sourced their own kit, made their own decisions, have got to the start, and are putting themselves through something they've never done before.
Yeah.
So that's more appealing to me. So
I completely agree. And so the Pan Celtic has been going now since 2018?
Well, yeah. So we launched the very first web, we launched like a teaser page online on 2018, just a single image on the top of BF in a bar.
Yeah.
We were doing the recce at the time. It just looked like a great, it was a great image to get. And then, 2019 was the first one. And then we had 2020, which had to be postponed.
Yeah.
Due to the pandemic. And then a lot of work and timing and good timing and a bit of luck. We were able to run it in 2021 in between the various different lockdowns.
Yeah.
And then, we're back again this year for our third edition. So we're one edition behind where we should be, but we're still on track for the 5-year sort of plan with the with this first phase, if you like, of the Pan Celtic, because phase two is being dreamt up already, which is year 6 to 10.
Yeah.
We're edging now towards the end of year five. Well, the cycle, which is interesting.
Yeah. It's cool. It's really cool. It's been, and what I like as well is that what I quite like about when I'm thinking about a race that I want to do, I go down the route of going, is this one I have to plan a route, or has the route been planned for me? That's a serious consideration that comes into it, because that's another thing that takes up quite a lot of time.
Yeah, and I think there's a space for, there's definitely a place for events where there's like a checkpoint and then you plan your own route to it. I mean, there's some, I've done events like that and they're amazing. Yeah. But for me, it's, and it is a place for that, but I personally like to have, to go and do an event where the route has already been pre-planned. So each, so you start off as a bunch of riders together on this route.
Yeah.
You're going to be encountering each other a lot during the whole event. And that's where, you know, it's, that's for me where the magic happens, is when the riders randomly encounter each other on the route. And that happens a lot. I mean, on an event where you plan your own route, it can happen. It can be like two, three radical atoms just colliding like cyclists, and you have this moment and it goes. But those moments happen more frequently on a set route. And also from an organizer's point of view, I would rather know that the roads that the people are going to ride down rather than just leave it to them to plan it. You know, for me, it's, could we go out and do a route recce, the whole recce, then we do a risk assessment turn by turn.
Mm.
Just finished it yesterday, the risk assessment for this year's route, and that was 585 pages of risk assessment, and it was something like 145,000 words in that risk assessment.
Jeez.
That's just for the long route. Now Toby's working on the risk assessment for the shorter route because it does like a different, goes in a different direction.
So yeah, it cuts in land, doesn't it? Quite significant.
Toby's working on that now, so I'm guessing that's going to be about 380 for that. That, well, I guess it could be anything, but it's going to be quite a sizable document. But we do all that so that when the riders come and ride it, they know that we've been along that road. It's a road that we would ride ourselves, that anything that would cause us concern, we have a look at a control measure to, you know, remedy it, or we don't send them down the road, we send them down somewhere else.
Yeah.
The thing is as well about planning a route is that we can make sure that the riders experience what we want them to experience almost. So we spend a lot of time looking at, because it's, we focus on the sort of the Celtic culture and heritage. So when we're planning a route, I'll have a look at what's sort of in that area that we're passing through, whether there's any sort of standing stones, any stone circles, ancient burial chambers, stuff like that, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And then I'll see then if we can route past it or go through it or near it. And then it's combined with like, okay, well, what great climbs are there? What great sort of cycle ways are there? So it takes, you know, the route planning takes a long time, but the end result is that it's, you know, the riders are in for a treat day after day after day. And the route almost is telling a story as well. You know, everything makes sense. So we don't send somebody up to a big climb if there's no sort of payoff for it, or we don't send people out and back unless there's something special that we want them to see. You know, at this point here, everything has to make sense, because as a rider, as riders, myself, Toby and Beck, you know, we know how frustrating it can be if you just get sent up the steepest hill after the steepest hill after the steepest hill, or down this spit of land just to come back up and there's actually nothing much there. It's like, well, that wasn't much fun. That's frustrating.
So, yeah,
you know, our route is really carefully planned and curated.
It's lovely to hear, and I'd say in similarly, I've had experiences where I've done races and events and been like, what's the point of this section?
Yeah.
And when you're tired, and you know, in a racing context, whether or not you're racing it, you know, you're racing it or enjoying it, but when you're tired and fatigued, it will be something that I found personally probably similar for you, that it bugs you for quite a while. And then I remember at one race, I won't say who, I won't say what race, but I remember at one race, a person involved in that race sent a very, very, or a situation happened on the route where it was not a nice bit to deal with. It was basically like effectively climbing up a sewage pipe, kind of, or a sewage section. I mean, it was dry, but it still stunk and it still wasn't enjoyable. And a certain person was very pissed off about it and made it very well known on social media to the race organizer. And I remember watching it thinking, shit. But then also thinking, that's a gut reaction to the situation where he's exhausted and frustrated and just kind of venting out. But, you know, there's always, hindsight's a magical thing. But no, I think there's something lovely about knowing that the three of you have really spent the time to research and understand the route, and that the route is also different every year. So I can't even fathom the amount of work that goes into that. It's so, you know, huge credit to you guys.
Yeah. I mean, it's and I think the other thing to mention, because it takes a lot of my time to do it, so I'm going to tell you about it. But it's really boring. I mean, it's really is that to make sure that we're responsible organisers and that we're doing the best we can. One of the processes of having the route almost certified, if you like, and making sure that it's good to ride, is that we contact every single local authority along the route.
Yeah.
So that every highways department, every council, every police department or police station, and then it gets submitted to what's known as a safety advisory group as well. So all this stuff happens, you know, with the race. All the risk assessments, all the insurance policies, everything gets sent out to these people almost in like an open consultation. So it gives them a chance to let us know of any future works that might be happening on the route or any concerns they might have. But it also then gives us peace of mind, which hopefully then gives the riders peace of mind, you know, that the route shouldn't throw up any surprises. However, life always throws up surprises. So, you know, it's like you have to take everything with a grain of, you know, a big pinch of salt, I guess. But
yeah,
we go as far as we can to make that race as safe as we can make it. But that's not to say it's sort of almost sterile, if you like, because once the riders go, that's it, that they're on, you know, they're out there by themselves. We just know that the route is good.
Yeah, you've done as much as you can within your power to make it as safe and it's exciting for someone racing it, and then whatever they experience on their own race is, that's it, that's the situation it is.
Yeah We set a board and they go and play then.
Yeah That's a good way of thinking about it, actually.
And that's exactly what it is. You know, we don't control the riders. There are no strings being pulled. We just make sure that the the sand pit is clean of dog poo, and there's no cat poo in the sand pit, and it's good to play.
Okay, that's the best description of it I've ever heard. As someone that has a dog as well, who I woke up this morning, I've got a labradoodle, and he's like, looks like a grumpy old man. Got up this morning and he just looked at me and was like, we put him in a crate at night because he's puppy, and it's just a good way of knowing that he's not going to cause any carnage. And generally he's pretty good, but this morning he woke up and looked at me and gave me the most awful looking, like, side eye look of like, you bastard, you've left me in here again. So took him out, no issues at all, bouncing around, jumping around, being a puppy. But I'm slightly digressing here, but I've had dogs and cats, and I love the idea of the sand pit. And cats are always like, cats are great, because they, if you piss them off, they're going to do something to you.
Yeah.
A dog is unconditionally going to love you. But this morning was one of those moments where my dog looked at me and was like, you prick. Gave it 5 minutes, gave him some breakfast, problem solved, no issues. A cat, on the other hand, would probably then go and, you know, shit in, I don't know,
one of your cycling shoes or something.
Plant pot, something like that, cycling shoe, you know, something to kind of cause a bit of trouble. So with the this year, this is this year's edition starts in, a week and a half, as you said?
Starts, yes. We head off week Sunday.
Yeah, it's crazy soon. And the route is starting in St. David's and then ferry across to Ireland. And then effectively both routes are sort of following the southwestern coast around. And then the short but still long route cuts inland, and then the longer route carries on following the coast, and then basically comes back into Dublin.
Yeah.
And then ferry across back into that little point of Wales I can't remember the name of, but it's the end of the Llanlas Cymru ride. And then you go across to Llandelo.
Yeah, that's it.
And I've never ridden in Ireland, and I can imagine that Ireland is absolutely amazing to ride in, especially following the coast. But I've ridden a lot in Wales, and, you know, Wales is just ridiculously beautiful, challenging. I imagine Ireland's very similar. And as you said, like the previous edition, so the 2021 edition was all kept in England and Wales?
Yeah, because we couldn't, the travel restrictions just made it nigh impossible to go over to Ireland, because we were going to be going to Ireland that year with the pandemic still sort of happening. We just extended it a little bit more in England and a little bit more in Wales. We made it a great route, actually.
Yeah, it looked fantastic.
But so after missing out on Ireland last year, we made a decision, right, let's go and do Ireland, but do it properly.
Yeah.
For Ireland, the West Coast. It's very much like Wales, but it just seems to be a little bit bigger again. It's just Wales that's had maybe, I don't know. But yeah, basically it's Wales 1.5 or something like that.
Wales on crack.
I was going to say something like that, but I don't
know. You could say it, it's fine.
Wales on juice, that's what it's like.
Wales on juice.
Yeah.
The bit that, and I've always like paid attention to the, like had a rough indication of what the routes have been doing. And the one that I'm going to ask you as someone who's genuinely interested in racing it at some point, is it ever going to go to the Isle of Man?
Yeah, of course it is.
Because that's where my family's from.
Yeah. Next year we have already worked out the route for where we're going to be. And we're starting next year in Brittany.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
This is one of the Celtic nations. And we're going to do around about 950 miles over in Brittany and then cross over to Portsmouth. And then head up the borders between England and Wales, because we've never been up through the borders.
Yeah.
And it looks like it could well finish on the Isle of Man next year.
Right, I'll see you there next year then.
Yeah. Or if it didn't finish there next year, because that the last bit still got to be determined, Isle of Man would feature in the year 5, and that would be a time trial. Everyone will get a time, and then once everyone's got a time, we then cross over, and then the route goes from there. But it's also got to fit in with the magnum opus, which is our 5-year grand plan, if you like, for those riders that have done 2 Pan Celtics. So
nice. So I all of my mum's side of my family are from the Isle of Man, but my dad lives in the Isle of Man. My parents split up when I was really young, and my dad's an ex-TT racer, British sidecar champion, like genuine madman on a motorbike. And the amount of like having as a kid, I used to go over there, used to go there as like summer holidays, basically, because my parents split up when I was really young. And we would basically go there to when he was racing, if it was the TT or the Manx Grand Prix. So the TT is the big one. The Manx Grand Prix is just exactly the same race, but just not as necessarily as famous racers doing it. But it's kind of changed that a lot of the big name racers will do it because it's time on the track. And my dad would be like, oh, I'll give you a job to do while I'm racing. I was like, yeah. This is me at like, you know, I don't know, 10 till probably 18, if not longer. Yeah, I'm well up for it. What's the job? And he would give me the most mundane jobs that made me feel like I was so part of the team and so vital to him racing. It was normally wiping the visor of his helmet and off the bike. That was it.
Job then.
It's a proper job that I can't see about that, you know, it's an important job. And there's the amount of stories that come out to anyone that's gone to the Isle of Man and firstly ridden or driven that circuit knows how incredible the road surface is for it, because it's maintained to such a high standard every year. But going around that circuit with someone that's raced it, there's all these like funny stories about different parts of the track. And my dad's quite blunt. He's originally from Newcastle. He's really blunt. And he's like, you go down the main stretch, which then drops down, it's called Bray Hill. And there's a hedge on the left-hand side of someone's garden with like a V cut into it. And the guy that, he's passed away now, but the guy that used to live there was called Bobby. And he used to sit there on a deck chair watching the racing. And my dad, not the last time, but the time before I went over there, we drove around the circuit and he was just explaining to me how you'd race it, what was the racing line, what you'd aim for. And it's fascinating. And the one bit that always stands in my head is that he would go and he would aim for Bobby He's like, literally, he's like, I'm aiming to be in his front garden. I want to go into his front garden. If I'm going to crash, I'm going to land on the deck chair in his garden. That's the plan. And he's like, you do that until literally you do not think you're going to be able to turn away. And that's the point that you turn. And I was just sitting there thinking, you're nuts.
Yeah.
You know, he's like 63 now. And he only really retired when he was like mid 40s. Like, yeah, there's so many stories like that about the Isle of Man. And there's a big kind of, there's a fascinating history, Celtic history, and just, you know, all kinds of fascinating stories about like Norse gods and like the gods of the seas around there, which you, when you go there, you can really like, there's loads of amazing places to learn about it. Like the one that always sticks in my mat, in my head, is my favorite place in the island, which is called the Calf of Man. It's like the southwestern point of the island, and it's really tight roads, steep roads to get to it. And you go through like this old, I can't think what, it's like an Anglo-Saxon town that they've like regenerated, and it's like a tourist site. And you go past that, and then you carry on like rolling down towards the Calf of Man. There's a little cafe there, but this is the point where there's like a little island off it, and just you get the seals and whales and dolphins, and sit there. I sit there for hours and just watch what was going on, whether it was, if it was awful weather inside the cafe, if it wasn't awful weather, just on a bench outside. And then if I was riding it, I'd then be psyching myself up to ride away from it because it's really lumpy. And then, yeah, it's a beautiful place. I could talk about it for a long time. And unfortunately, I've not been able to. Pardon?
I get the impression you could.
Yeah.
Talk about it for a long time. Yeah.
And unfortunately, I've not been able to go there a lot recently. They, you know, proper closed the borders during COVID and with the lockdowns. And it was something that the Isle of Man had very few COVID cases. So sadly, I managed to get out there end of last year, but was very, very sick. So didn't actually get to do a lot. It wasn't COVID. I just had a very, very bad cold and flu case. But it's like, as a player to me, there's such a heritage in cycling with the Isle of Man as well, obviously caused by a certain Manxman who's not going to the Tour de France, it seems. But there's been a heritage of really good cyclists coming out of the Isle of Man for a long time. And there's never really been anything on the ultra side that's gone there. There has been like stage races, and they've done like mountain bike races across the island, but nothing on the context of ultra. There was at one point a 24-hour race, which was 24 hours around the Manx circuit, but it's open road, so it's kind of a bit sketch. But yeah, beautiful place. I'm looking forward to the moment that Pan-Celtic otherwise finishes there or does the time trial around it, because that's pretty mega. On a loaded bike, a TT would be brilliant. I think it'd be brilliant right at the end.
Yeah, something like that. We've got to work out the detail, but that's the idea of it.
Yeah, nice. And then the other thing, I guess, to bring up as well is the gravel rally. Now, that was new for this year, right?
Yeah, so the gravel rally is something that has been in the works since the very first email I sent to the Forestry Commission. Well, I was looking at it about a month ago. It was back in February 2019. Mm-hmm. So it's taken that long. I mean, the pandemic didn't help, but still we were able to plan it and refine it and get it all signed off and get the permissions, because that's the big, I mean, you have a look, there are very few cycling events happening around Snowdonia, you know.
Yep.
Off-road gravel, actually in Snowdonia, there's lots of stuff happening around the periphery and the borders of it, but there's none really happening right in the heart of Snowdonia. And the reason for that is it takes a huge amount of work to get permissions and agreements and licenses and what have you to go around these, all these different areas, because some of them will be like SSIs, sites of specific scientific interest, or they'll be places that are owned by the National Trust or by Snowdonia National Park or by Natural Resource Wales or by an energy company there that looks after a lot of the lakes and the leets. And then you've got the tenant farmers, and then you've got the local people to speak to, and then you've got the businesses to speak to. So it does take a lot of work to do. But yeah, it happened this year, and we kept the numbers quite small purposefully so that we could basically just try and create like a nice personal vibe about it. Because what I like about organizing events, what I really like about it, is meeting new people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you have something that's too big, then you never get the chance to meet everybody. And if you do meet everybody, it's just a diluted interaction. You know,
yeah.
I spent a long time looking at all of the different brevet cards from this year's race. If you have a look on our website, every rider's got their own brevet card with their own personal details on there. And that becomes almost like their passport, if you like, to progress across the different checkpoints and across the route. And yeah, I've taken a lot of time to try and remember names to faces at this point now. So, you know, I'll probably forget a lot of them, but, you know, I've been trying to learn them so that when I meet people for the first time at the start, I'll be able to know who they are, and I'll know what their favourite drink is, say, or I'll know something about them. And that's important to me, is getting to know the people that ultimately pay and want to be a part of what you're doing. And that, you know, it's a big honour to me. It's a big responsibility. And I take it very seriously. Going back to the gravel rally, because I digress quite a bit as well, Chris, so you have to rein me in now and again. But going back to the gravel rally, we kept it small. We had typical Welsh weather for that one day. It was pretty horrendous at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's like I was saying to a lot of the people that were there, you know, we had 100 people, 108 people sign up, and then we had some, because we said it'd be 100, and then we had 8 people, you know, just absolutely pleading with us, preparing to walk on broken glass to get a place. We said, right, okay, we'll up it to 108 and that's it.
Yeah.
So, we had 108, and then with the forecast not looking great, you get people then deciding that they're not wanting to ride in the rain.
Yeah.
Fine. But then what it does mean is that the people that turn up to race, they're there to race.
Yeah.
What kind of day it is. They know what's ahead of them and they're there. So you know that the people there are either all, you know, they'll finish, or they're going to give it a bloody good go at finishing, but they're not going to sort of like back out after the first sort of damp cloud or something like that. They're there for the day. And that's great. And yeah, we had an amazing day riding. At the end of it, or even within the first hour, the riders, as we were turning up to the first checkpoint, we had like a feed station, wasn't a checkpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a surprise as well. We didn't tell anybody about it, but we hired up this mountaineering hub, and then as the riders were cycling past, it was just like waving them in and giving them sausage bertties, or, you know, different sandwiches and cakes and all sorts. So that was cool.
That's really nice. It looked, I've seen like quite a lot of the photos from it, and just thought, because when I was doing this Seven Everest project, Toby came and rode with me on, I can't remember what day it was. Basically, he conveniently happened to be at Stoolan Dam for work.
Mm.
And yeah, brought his bike along, and came and did, how many reps did he? He probably did like a couple of hours of me. It's all a bit of a blur, to be honest, that whole week. And yeah, I did an interview yesterday with Cycling Weekly about it, and the guy was like, oh, you know, what happened on this day and this day? And I was like, I'll be completely honest with you, mate. I rode up and down a hill for a week. What happened on what day is a bit of a blur. But yeah, Toby came along, I think it was probably like Wednesday or Thursday. And it was just before the gravel rally. I think it was literally the week before it. And I said to him, like, I've been like keeping an eye on it for a while, but because I'd known I was doing this challenge, I knew I wasn't going to be able to do it. Because basically, as soon as I did that challenge, I was like, I'm going on holiday, going away for a week, just going to go and sit by a beach and ignore my phone. Because I needed to, for my own physical and mental well-being, just to ignore life. And obviously, though, I kept the tabs on what was going on with it. And the photography that has come out of it is so epic. Because partly, I think, because of the scenery and, you know, the typical Welsh weather, as you said. But, like, it just looks freaking cool. It looked really cool.
It was like, for me, it's like the filthiest Paris-Roubaix ever.
You know,
the way the riders were turning up after just an hour in the race, let alone at the end. At the end, they would like they'd been like through World War One, you know, fighting in the trenches or something through the Somme. They were just filthy and battered.
Yeah.
They had just like big, huge smiles on their face, and just like face covered in mud and just white teeth.
You know, yeah.
It was cool, really funny to see.
Yeah, it was really cool. And as you say, they really did feel like there was a great community to it as well. And I love the fact that I think I saw Toby posting some photos of him on a quad bike or something, which is just brilliant. He looked way too happy for being on a quad bike, I thought.
He enjoyed himself. It was a tough day for him, though, because he spent, you know, it was raining most of the day. And, you know, it's one thing riding in those conditions because you're exerting energy and you're staying as warm as you can.
Hmm.
Poor old Toby and Jack, because we had a filmmaker on the back, Jack from Friction Collective.
Yeah.
They were having to just literally just stay mobile while, you know, just sitting still on this machine. So they got properly cold and wet. But hopefully when the film comes out, Jack's making a small little promo film about the gravel rally. So that'll be pretty cool.
Yeah, nice. And as the intention is to continue that going as well as the Pan Celtic race as well throughout the years.
Yeah, so just how we plan and organise a Pan-Celtic that goes to different Celtic nations each year, the plan is to build a series of gravel races so that ultimately it will be a season of gravel races that run throughout the year. So, for example, we'd have February would be, I don't know, Scotland, so we'd have a gravel race in Scotland, and then we'd have April, something on the Isle of Man, July, the gravel Pan Celtic, and then we'd have some maybe on Ireland, something in Brittany, and then finishing off in Wales. I mean, that's a long-term plan of creating this series of gravel races, and then people can compete in different places and you know, have like a world championship gravel rally or something like that. I don't know, we'd do something with it, but you know you race all five and you'd have one race at the end to determine who the champion is.
Be like best all rounder sort of job.
Yeah, something like that. But yeah, that's the long-term plan. And then we've got some exciting stuff planned for the gravel, for the Pan-Celtic in year 6 and 7.
Mm.
So that's going to be a slight departure of what we've done up to then, but it'll still be all around the Celtic race of people and the culture and the music and the food, because, you know, that's the great stuff, the food.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, all this stuff that defines who Celtic people are. So
how did the idea of doing a Celtic-themed race come around? How did it all start?
So, to give a little bit of credit to my wife, I did TCR, and then my wife said to me, oh, you'll want to organise something like this. And at the time, I thought, no, I won't want to organise anything like that. Because I do have a history of organising bike races, more like British cycling races, one-day events.
Mm-hmm.
I did quite a few of them over the years, organising and racing. And I had no intention of organizing an ultra, but then I was out riding with my friend one day and we were talking about the experiences that I had on the Transcon, and like with anything, you have good experiences and you have bad experiences, and that sort of makes up the whole end product of your time doing it. And it's always it's always good, you go through the hard experiences to appreciate the good stuff. And we were talking about it. And I said to him, I said, you know what, I wouldn't actually mind organising a race that went just around Wales, maybe just to come to Cardiff and back, or around the periphery of Wales. And this is going back to 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said to him, yeah, that'd be good. Actually, we could maybe do it. So if we went down to South Wales, crossed an island, come up through Ireland, cross back over to... And it was just... And he was just like, yeah, sounds like a good idea. I was just bouncing him off him. And then I mentioned it to my wife, and then she was like, yeah, that sounds pretty good. And then I started reading about Ireland, Wales, and then sort of, because obviously I knew about the Celtic nations, but the more I understood about it, I just thought, yeah, there's a great opportunity here to take people who are either, you know, of Celtic heritage, if you like, or who aren't, and take him on a bit of a journey. I hate the word journey because it's just so overused, it's a cliche. But the intention has always been to take him on a trip, then, Ralph. Don't call it a journey, but on a trip, you know, through places they might not normally go, to see things they wouldn't normally see, to smell, to taste, to hear things they wouldn't normally see, and just inform, if you like, and educate people, and good time as well. You know, it's not... You know, it's not all about just going from A to B as quick as you can for me. There'll be people that do that. We had Angus Young last year race, and wow, what a, you know, just a mind-blowing effort he made. And
yeah,
guys that were chasing him down, Chris Pitbardo and Paul Wainwright, what an amazing effort they did.
Yeah.
They had great experiences. But there is a, there's another side to the race where people are going that bit slower, can just soak in more, can experience more. So I do think to win a race, you sacrifice so much, or to be in the top 10 sometimes, you sacrifice a lot to get that position, you know, at the expense of not seeing and experiencing a bit. You know, for me, if I was doing the trans, if I was racing this, if I was doing Pan Celtic this year, I would make it a point of doing, I don't know, 160 miles a day and then stopping and then finding a nice little Irish pub, having a few Guinness, a pot of beef stew or something like that, and then sleep and then just get up.
I
want to get out of it this year, I think.
Yeah, I think having done, so previously I've done Silk Road, Atlas Mountains and Badlands are probably the three, I guess, big boys that I've done. And Badlands was the first one that I went, because I went into Badlands with, I do a lot of time trialing, and I went into I basically really mucked myself out up at the National 100 TT. To the point that, so basically I think I got 50 miles into it and I was like, pace was good. I was like, probably aiming for like a top 10 in the National 100, which is amazing when you consider I'm not really I just enjoy time trialing. I don't do it that's not my main focus. And so I was doing well, feeling good, like speeds were good, power was good. And then about 60 miles in, something just went snap in my leg. And then I remember thinking, right, I've got a couple of choices here. One, I continue riding really hard and really ruin myself. Two, I rein it in and just try to finish. Or three, I just pull out. And I went for the second option of just like reining it in and finishing. And I finished, I think I was still top 20, top 30, probably somewhere around that number. And got to the sort of hobbled off the bike and basically drove home, because that was in somewhere in Wales as well. I can't remember where exactly, but basically drove home and got home, went straight to the doctors pretty much when I got home, and that basically I'd like torn something in my leg. So I then knew that was like July, Badlands was September. I was like, that's not really enough time to kind of get back some fitness. It's kind of enough time to sort of heal, recover, and sort of start riding again. But I kept having all these continual setbacks, and where the recovery just wasn't quite going as well, the physio wasn't quite going as well as it should have done. And I think I got to the start of Badlands, and I think I basically went out there with having ridden probably for about 2 weeks before starting the race. I think I had 2 weeks of sort of light training, getting used to riding a bike, checking the setup, a week of chilling, and then went out to do Badlands. So I very, very publicly put it out there that I was not racing it. And I did it very publicly because that then took the pressure away from me. And it meant that actually I could really enjoy it and enjoy the route. And it is a damn challenging route, that one, especially last year because of the heat more than anything. Like someone recorded like 50 something degrees on their Garmin at one point, which is mental. And, you know, you are riding in the middle of some of the deserts of Spain, I guess. They're not all necessarily classed as deserts, but one of them is the only desert in Europe. And I just completely reined it in and was like, right, I'm going to ride as far as I feel like I can. And when I want to go to sleep, I'm going to go to sleep. You know, that's it. I'm going to go stop in a little Spanish restaurant for dinner, get some tapas, get some, you know, some local food, which basically is normally is always like a Spanish omelette and bread and peppers, that kind of stuff. I love Spanish food. So I was like, I'm going to get a nice dinner, carry on riding for a little bit until I feel like I'm going to fall asleep. And then I'm going to stop, have a sleep, get up when the sun comes up and go again. And it meant I genuinely enjoyed it. You know, there is an element, as you say, there is something incredible when people really do race and go to town for these. It's a real sporting achievement, but you probably do lose a lot of the being able to soak in and absorb what you're seeing, especially if the route has been so, you know, well, almost curated and chosen as well.
I mean, I say all that and it's nice to soak it all in. I went and rode the Cromwellioi, and I'm not even, I think I know how to say it, is Cromwellioi, but it's not, it's something like Cromwellioch or something. I wrote that this year, and that was organised by some really good friends of mine, Joanne and Thomas, Yuri, and I forget the other guy's name, and he's going to kill me. But anyway, they organised it, great event, and I had it in my mind where I was just going to ride it, not super quick, you know, because when will I go back and do it again? Hopefully next year, but you know, you never know.
Yeah.
I just wanted to just, you know, make a point of seeing stuff. But I ended up just pushing myself really hard, you know. And yeah, you ride through the night, so you're missing, you know, you should be sleeping a little bit during the night so that when you're riding, you see these things during the day. Yeah, that was good. But I'll tell you really quick, because I'm probably going to have to, if you don't mind, pull it in a little bit, only because I'm off down to London today.
Yeah, you are, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm off down to Luckman No Hands. Albion and Dot Watcher are doing a little event there for us. So I'm off to get my hair cut. So
hey, you took. I need a haircut.
Put the hat back on, actually, please. Put it back on. I'm joking. anyway, before I go, I wanted to just tell you, and this genuinely did happen, and I haven't mentioned this Christian because I haven't seen him just mention it. But when I rode the Cromwellioi, before the start, the organiser, Joanne, had made a point of saying, make sure you have at least 1.5 litres of water because opportunities to replenish your water on, like they are, say, in the rest of Europe or in the UK or other places, there's not a great network of 24-hour garages. You're out up in the mountains quite a lot, so there's not so many shops. There are some wells, but you know they're not as frequent as you'd like. So make sure you have enough water. Great.
Okay. Yeah.
So the morning, the night before the race, we were staying at Joanne's house, and there's a few people there, and we all ended up having a little bit of a drink, probably too much to drink the night before an event. Woke up during the day. I probably didn't drink as much fluids as I should have had. It was a record-breaking heat wave in Spain during the day, so it's just scorching hot. And the race started at 7 p.m. Off we went, great. Nice pace to begin with. It was neutralized for the first 50 kilometers. So everyone was like the front bunch of people just nailing it.
Yeah, of course, always the way.
Because we could just sit together, so we're just nailing it. And then it became unneutralized and off we went. And I was drinking my water, not as much as I should have done, but after about 5 hours, I'd gone through my first litre. So I was thinking, right, I've got to stop thinking now about replenishing my water. And I rode past somebody's house and there was a guy there watering his plants. So I stopped, went up to him, can you fill up my bottle? He filled up my litre bottle. I downed a whole litre, could do it again. He filled it up halfway, I necked that, and then he topped it back up for me. So I had a litre and a half of water, carried on riding. And then a few hours later, I just started to feel a little bit off, not great, not good at all. My legs started to feel heavy, and I pull over, and I was ill. I was like threw up all this water. My legs just started to cramp, felt fucked basically.
It's about
3 o'clock in the morning. So I thought, right, I'm gonna have to sleep. But I actually thought to myself, right, I'm just gonna scratch. This is not good. I'm feeling really poorly. But then Mike Hall's mantra, never scratch at night, always sleep on it. So I went into the field and I had no food on me at that point because I'd eaten it and I didn't want to carry much to begin with. The only things I had was an energy gel, Sturka, and 2 salt caffeine tablets. And I know that I remember, not tablets, but powders. Yeah. And I remember my vet friend, Peter Harlow, saying to me that the best time to take caffeine is just before you go to sleep.
Yeah.
Because it helps open up he's saying about your veins and your whatever, it helps open them a little bit, dilate them, and then when you wake up, you're raring to go a bit.
Yeah.
But that always felt a bit of a contradiction. Anyway, I took these 2 salt caffeine tablets, and at this point, I was really like dehydrated and cramped, and then went to sleep, and I slept I was off the bike for 5 hours, and when I woke up the next morning, I was good to go. So, whether or not Sturka saved my ride, I don't know. And we're not going to say it did necessarily because it would just make Christian's head go, woo! but it did. So I went to sleep, dehydrated, I'd thrown up, cramped. I took these 2 salt salt and caffeine powder things that he'd given me to go over with. And when I woke up in the morning, I felt, yeah, okay, I can do this. But when I woke up, I was literally the last person. I was at the very back, and I'd gone from being at the front at one point to being at the back, and everyone had about 5 hours ahead of me. So then the rest of my race was spent chasing them, which is great. It actually worked out really well from a psychological point of view, because it
just
my teeth, a carrot in front of me constantly. I made some good friends on there as well.
Nice.
So, Matt, yeah, that's my little anecdote. Stürka saved my ride in possibly. But yeah, I certainly think it helped. And I think the problem with the water was my friend was explaining to me afterwards, that once you get out of cities and out of towns, a lot of the water supply comes from wells. So with a pump, and where the land's been farmed and you've had stuff growing on it, all the nitrates that have been the fertilizers, they sink down into the water table, which then feeds into the wells. So, you know, the local people, where they can help it, they don't drink water from the wells, so it's bottles. And
it's always the magic of hindsight, hey, but when you need water, you need water at the end of the day. Been there, done that on Badlands, and even as recently as this ride across Switzerland, where I ran out of water and basically just went into like a shop and was like, have you got a tap, can you fill it up? My mates had water, so they were fine, and I just downed these bottles of water. And then that night I was like very, very sick for about, well, it's like it got to like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up with really bad cramps. It's like holding my stomach. And then I think from about 2:30 till about 4:30 in the morning, it's just coming out of everything, ears, nose, everywhere, you know, just leaking, not good stuff. And same thing, took salt tablet, salt powder, did exactly the same thing, because I was like, I'm definitely dehydrated now. I just need to drink and get some salts back in my system. It probably didn't help being in the heat and everything. And I did the same thing as you. Didn't go for a caffeine one, but when I had one of the normal sachets left and just popped in the water bottle, downed it, eventually got back to sleep. And I woke up the next day and we'd got to where we were staying in Berbia. My mate Francis, who I was sharing with, I woke up the next day. He obviously heard and saw everything that night and was like, wow, you're really poorly. Woke up the next day and he looked at me and was like, how you doing? And I was like, yeah, I'm not too bad. I feel a little bit fragile, but nowhere near as bad as I felt.
Yeah, good.
Anyway, Matt, thank you so much for your time today. Have a fantastic haircut.
Yeah, mate.
I hope you're going to go for something, you know, some highlights.
I need to. And the grey's starting to come through.
That's why I keep it short on the side, because I've got a few greys coming up now. And that's why I normally don't have a beard anymore, because there's loads of greys in this bit. But yeah, have a fantastic time at Look Mum No Hands as well. I used to live 10 minutes away from there, so I miss it quite a lot. It was my local cafe. Love that place. And good luck with everything with the race this year. I'm going to be following along, and I will put a link to the website in the description for the podcast as well, because if you don't know about the Pan-Celtic race, please go and check it out. It's a really cool event. It's happening in the UK. And you know, I've been following it along for years, and it's been one that I've just continually gone, can I make it work this year or not? And having had the conversation with you now, I think I need to make it work for next year, to be perfectly honest with you. So yeah, thank you so much, and I'm sure I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, cool, take it easy, see you later.
Cheers.